Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is midlife so dreary for so many people? Many are well-established in their careers, in their 40s, have built families and bought homes. In short, they have begun to achieve many of the things they dreamed about earlier in life. And yet, many people in their 40s across multiple cultures find themselves asking, wait, is this all there is? It's a vexing, frankly depressing question, all the more so because so many of us struggle with it. The good news, as my guest has learned, is that our answer to that question changes with time, so that a few years later, we start to feel far more content with who we are and what we have. Journalist Jonathan Rauch is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His article, The Real Roots of Midlife Crisis, appears in the December issue of The Atlantic magazine, where he is a contributing editor. Jonathan, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here.
What is a midlife crisis exactly?
Well, most of the time, it's not a crisis. A better word for it might be a midlife slump, or in my case, it was a kind of mild midlife depression. And that's, I think the best way to put it is that for a lot of people, it's harder to be satisfied in the middle of life. It's harder to feel grateful. It's not impossible. Many people do. Many people sail through this part of life in grand style. But it's harder for a lot of us, and it certainly was for me. Now, a few people, I think, misjudge what's going on and overreact and sometimes make big mistakes. And I think that's where we get the cliche of the midlife crisis, you know, the big disruption, the shock, the strange behavior. But that's really very rare. What's really much more common is this kind of dragging feeling in the middle of life, that there must be more to it, but where is it?
You're candid here in the piece about your own experience with this sort of ennui in your 40s. You were very successful. You were in a good relationship, and yet you had these escapist fantasies, like you wanted to break away somehow and do something totally different.
Yeah, ennui is such a good word for it, especially in the mornings. I was smart enough to realize that what was happening to me was not rational. It was strange because my life was objectively going wonderfully in my 40s. I could, you know, it would sound like bragging if I said how well things were going. Yet I'd wake up in the morning and think, what's the matter with me? Why am I wasting my life? There must be more to it. These were kind of unbidden, unwelcome, almost obsessive, compulsive disorder kinds of things. Not severe enough so that I seriously considered psychiatric help, but serious enough so that I began to think of myself over the course of my 40s as someone who was just a malcontent. You know, I just wasn't going to be satisfied as a human being anymore, and I didn't really like that. And that was a hard period, partly because it was so perplexing.
Yeah, what's interesting is that I guess it's complicated by the fact that you knew that objectively everything was okay, and so therefore it made you seem,
I suppose,
a bad person almost.
I felt tempted to walk in and, you know, quit my column, which was a great column for a great magazine, and I knew that was crazy. Luckily, I wasn't tempted to throw away my happy relationship. Some people, of course, do that. So I started trying to explore where this was coming from. And around the time I was 50 or so, which is I'm now 54, two things happened at once. One is imperceptibly at first and then little by little, this sense of gloom, of dissatisfaction began to lift, even though when I turned 50, a lot of bad things actually did happen. So objectively, it's still going the other direction. But I began to feel grateful again. I began to feel satisfied. I stopped beating up on myself. The second thing that happened was I discovered through a colleague here at Brookings, Carol Graham, this literature, scientific literature in economics of all places that finds a very common pattern. Cultures all over the world, countries everywhere exhibit this. It's called the U-shaped life satisfaction curve, and it finds a very common pattern of exactly what I was experiencing. And that's when the light bulb went on, and I said, aha, this isn't just about me.
So what could explain the fact that we, I guess, start out in very early adulthood feeling pretty good, and then it goes down and down and down until it bottoms out in the 40s?
Well, first of all, just to remind everyone who's listening, this is not everybody. Human
right.
beings are not simple. It's a common pattern, but it's, you know, this doesn't apply to everyone. So nothing is fixed and concrete. The second thing, caveat for people who listen, is this is at this point more of a what story than a why story. The U-curve is a result that falls out of economists with these huge data sets on life satisfaction in countries all over the world. And it's a statistical regularity. Explaining it, we're a little bit behind that. That's going to take some more research. But I think the best hypotheses I've seen have to do with expectations. People who are young tend to overestimate pretty seriously how happy, satisfied with life they'll be in 5 or 10 years, which means when they get there, they tend to feel disappointed. Over the middle of life, expectations seem to recalibrate because, after all, we expect to get old, and supposedly getting old is supposed to make us unhappy, right? Meanwhile, this U-curve begins to go away and begins to turn around. So around the age when I experienced it, early 50s, two things happen. First, your expectations are lower, so you're easier to satisfy. And second, your feeling about life starts to pick up again. So what seems to happen is that unpleasant surprises of youth and especially middle age begins to turn into pleasant surprises after middle age.
So in other words, you discover, well, this is not so bad after all.
Yeah. And you begin to realize, you know, actually what's going on here is pretty good. But there's other things that people think are happening. Older people are better at appreciating the positive. This has been shown in brain scans, you know, fMRI studies. Older people are less prone to experience regret. They're less emotionally volatile. So, you know, when you're young, everything that happens is the greatest thing or the worst thing ever. Older people exhibit traits that are more conducive to wisdom, which is really interesting. Wisdom is starting to emerge as a medical concept, not just folklore, but something that can really be identified and measured. And in many cases, that, of course, is associated with these traits like knowing more and having more stability, making better judgment calls. So all of these things may work together to make it easier to feel satisfied with life later in life. And in fact, that's what the statistics show.
So this is really fascinating, but highly counterintuitive. Life circumstances do not necessarily correlate to life satisfaction. So having or lacking what we think we want may not be what's driving our contentment, but it goes back, as you said, to this idea of expectations.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, Chris. And one of the big surprises, and one of the things that makes this all a little bit intriguing and mysterious, is I mentioned this U-curve is a statistical finding in economics. It often comes out most strongly after you statistically adjust for people's differences in life circumstances. So things like income, employment, marriage, kids, these things we think really matter. Even after you adjust for that, you still often find this age-related happiness curve. It's as if, apparently, age itself has some effect on our life satisfaction. And as if to bolster that, last year, a study came out finding the same general shape in life satisfaction with chimpanzees and orangutans. So this really suggests that there might be an underlying pattern, even a biological pattern, to life satisfaction in primates.
How do you ask a chimp how satisfied she is with her life?
You don't, but what you do is you ask the people who care for them in facilities in countries around the world, and there's a standard questionnaire that's used to gauge the well-being of animals in captivity, which these folks have to fill out. So you can compare the results of that and figure out, based on how the animals are behaving, how satisfied, how energetic, outgoing, and so forth they seem to be.
So we know at this point in human psychological history that we aren't necessarily rational creatures, and yet we always look for some external factor to explain our moods, right? I wonder how that plays into the reasons that we latch on to explain a midlife crises or ennui when it arrives.
It turns out that human beings are not really all that good at attributing what makes us happy or unhappy. And I guess at some level we all know this, right? The thing we think we always wanted, we get it, and it turns out not to be so good. The risk is that people misattribute this midlife slump and think, well, what's wrong with my life? What do I have to fix? And they latch on to something. You know, my marriage is terrible. My job is awful. I think of this as almost, in my case, it was like almost a parasitic wasp looking for something to be dissatisfied with. And that's where I think people often get into trouble. They'll misattribute what's going on and they'll lash out. They'll sometimes make rash decisions. And that's where we get this pattern that's sometimes called midlife crisis. But the good news, Chris, I regard all this as a really good news story, and I hope you do too in a couple of ways. The first is most people don't do wild and crazy stuff in middle age. They get through it, and that's what most of us do. But the second thing that's really good news here is that it gets better. In many cases, all you have to do is stick around. Don't do anything stupid and wait for your 50s to start rolling by and presto changeo. Not automatic, not in every case, but the statistics say you're likely to feel better about life.
What might the evolutionary purpose be of differing levels of satisfaction at different life stages?
Boy, I don't know. I've had people I talk to speculate on that, but here we get way into conjectural realms. But the ideas are things like, you know, you want young people to be very reactive and very energetic. And you want older people to be very pro-social and very wise and sort of compassionate and to be interested in helping others because they're not at reproductive age. And maybe there's a transition in between. But, you know, the truth is we're now talking way beyond the boundaries of respectable science.
Well, I'm really interested in this idea of sitting down in a lab and trying to quantify wisdom. We've known that it existed as long as human beings have been talking to one another, but it's always been a little bit hard to pin down, right?
To me, in a way, what was most interesting about writing this article and reporting it was the discovery that wisdom is real. I thought of it as, you know, it's a concept for philosophers or Aesop's moral tales, fables. Well, it turns out that there's a small but growing and very reputable school of psychiatrists who think that like stress, which was once thought to be a non-medical concept, wisdom is also a medical concept, a set of identifiable traits, which tend to be very similar from culture to culture over time period and across cultures and continents, which you can actually, there's a battery of tests for it now. People are working on that, and there are folks that I went and talked to that are putting people in brain scanners and trying to look at the roots of what we think are the traits of wisdom, things like compassion and emotional stability and so on. And that's, I think, a very positive thing. To me, part of the story that's emerging here is for a lot of us, and I hope this proves to be the case for me, Chris, this rough patch in the 40s and early 50s is a transition toward something like wisdom.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Jonathan Rausch. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the article The Real Roots of Midlife Crisis, which appears in the December issue of The Atlantic, where he is a contributing editor. If you'd like to share a story about your own experience with midlife crisis or with wisdom, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jonathan Rauch, who's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's a journalist who has just written an article for The Atlantic magazine, The Real Roots of Midlife Crisis. If you would like to join the conversation about midlife crisis, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Jonathan, it also seems that the transition in the 40s from youth, which is like the only state in which we've ever found ourselves before, to something that is decidedly not so young takes some getting used to as well. Is that part of this transition to a different phase of life, do you think?
Well, it was for me, but it wasn't so much conscious as just kind of getting through it. But yes, there's certainly an element of transition in how you think about yourself, a sense that, you know, there's going to be less time in life. It's hard to know the causal arrow, though, Chris. You know, is it in my case, it felt more like whatever the transition I was going through was changing my feelings about the world more than the other way around. And one thing we know is that as people get out of their 40s and into their 50s, for example, their values tend to change. They get more interested in friends, in their social links, in being connected, their social connections, and somewhat less interested in the competition, in status. And that happened to me, and it's actually a very, very welcome development. But it wasn't so much because I'm thinking about being in a different stage of life. It's almost more like something that happened to me.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, having that sense that you have to compare your progress in life to that of all your peers, you know, it's definitely kind of an exhausting characteristic of young adulthood and something I would imagine most people are happy to let go of when they're able to do so.
Yeah, and people, as they get older, also, it turns out, better at living in the here and now and not thinking about what could have been yesterday or what should be tomorrow. And I think I've begun to experience these. I tell people the best thing about 40s for me is that they ended and that 50s are a kind of gift. I had no idea that I'd recover not only some of the sense of gratitude and satisfaction that I thought were lost to me forever, but also that I've recovered some of the sense of adventure, of, oh, what the heck, try stuff. Life is still full of surprises that I had in my 20s and 30s.
Many people in their 40s are sort of coupled up permanently. How does this time in life tend to affect relationships?
Well, you know, that's a good question. Not something I particularly looked into. I can tell you that for a lot of people, of course, the middle of life is a hard time for relationships because, you know, especially if you've got two people dealing with their own sense of midlife slump and taking care of their parents and taking care of their kids and taking care of each other. It is a high stress period of life for a lot of people.
I love the idea that as people get older, they're more interested in like helping other people. Maybe it's about time, but it might just be about their orientation to the world.
You know, we don't really know the answer to this, Chris, but my guess based on the research that I did is that in 10 or 20 years from now, there are going to be findings that confirm that our minds, our brains actually change as we get older. Now, of course, we know that to be true, of course, and we know that sometimes the change is for the worse. There's some cognitive capabilities that get less sharp with age. And at the very end, you often get into stuff like dementia. But it also turns out the brain is an amazingly plastic organ, and as we get older, we harness more different parts of our brain to compensate for losses in specific areas. And my guess is we're going to find out that in some ways our brains actually change with age in ways that make it easier to live a more balanced, satisfied, less harried, competitive kind of life. I'm just guessing now, but I think that's kind of my sense of where this is going.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Rhonda in Murphy. Hi, Rhonda.
Yes, hi. Enjoying the conversation, and I too am in my 50s, and I have certainly learned through life experiences that there's more time behind me as opposed to in front of me. So that has been a catalyst to have me seek ways to be happy. But also, having lost my parents, my in-laws, and lots of my friends, even though we're all in our 50s, but to see people just like myself who have passed on has given me the impetus to be happy, but nothing so much like when my daughter was diagnosed with cancer 2 years ago. All the things that I might have been worrying about in my 40s and early 50s, nothing else mattered but to get my daughter healthy again. And I'm grateful to say that she is, but a year ago, December 9th, today, she was almost killed in a car accident.
Goodness.
So again, it's these kinds of things that life teaches us, that we shouldn't spend time looking backwards anymore. We should spend time with the people we care about and find ways to be happy, because life is indeed short and fleeting.
Rhonda, thank you so much for your call. Anything you want to respond to there, Jonathan?
Well, just wow. You know, talk about having a lot to deal with in the middle of life. All of that is very true. I just remind myself, you know, in my own case, it was so different from that because I had nothing to complain about during my 40s. Things were going great, and I still felt these feelings. And I think in some ways, that's what's especially hard for people like me and people that I talk to who didn't understand why these feelings were happening. You know, like they didn't have someone who had cancer or people dying. My parents were alive and mostly well in my 40s. And it's often those people that I particularly want to reach with this message, which is, you know, don't do anything rash. Don't assume that there's something wrong with you. Don't throw your life up in the air. This is a perfectly natural, very common transition that leads through to something much better.
From your experience or perhaps from your research, Jonathan, do you think the way we define happiness changes over the decades of our lives?
Oh, sure. Alluded to that earlier, but people, as we get older, we tend to define what satisfies us in life more in terms of our connections and more in terms of how much we're helping other people and society and less in terms of status and competition. For me, one of the gifts of my 50s is, although I'm certainly not immune to comparing myself with other people and thinking, well, how high am I relative to them? For me, that used to be an almost sometimes irrational preoccupation. I didn't want to do it, but unbidden, you know, it was like some primitive primate part of me saying, so how high am I on the hill compared to the other alpha males? And that's very much backed off. I quote someone in my article, a woman I talked to, as saying, I'm doing the same things every day. I just feel differently when I do them. And she's valuing differently. She's much more attuned to the people around her and the satisfaction she gets from her friendships and less worried about, is my job perfect today? Is my career exactly right? I should also mention, Chris, when we talk about happiness here, what we're talking about is life satisfaction. It's what scientists call evaluative happiness. It's not always mood. You know, mood you measure with questions like, how many times did you smile today? Life satisfaction is more like, overall, do you feel like your life is good or you want to be in life? And that's really the issue that we're talking about today.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Christopher in the Colony. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I have a question pertaining to the wisdom study, mm-hmm. and it's just one question. I'll take it off the air, and it's really just to get the remarks of the guest. It's, does setting things we understand to be ever-changing in order to create a class or understanding ruin the aspirations of individuality?
I'm not quite getting that.
I'm not either. Christopher, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Would you rephrase that for us?
Yes, I'm sorry. I wrote it down so I could try. It's basically, we understand, we're trying to study wisdom and we don't understand it fully. Things like that we let the public know about, other people aspire to be that way. And there's studies going on that's showing individuality is actually sacrificed as we all try to fit into a society. So I just wanted to get your guess. common.
Oh, no, not that I've heard of. I haven't seen anything that suggests individuality comes into it particularly. There is a pretty strong sense that wisdom is pro-social. It turns out that the traits that make people wise are more than the sum of the parts, and they're traits that it's good for society to have around. It's like being good, for example, at judging situations in an even-handed way, putting yourself in the other person's shoes, not overreacting, thinking compassionately about other people, stuff like that. It turns out that having wise people around is good for society, and I've never heard of a society that wanted fewer wise people. But if there's an element of either squelching or encouraging individuality, I haven't heard about it.
I'm interested in the intersection of gratitude and life satisfaction. You know, we've been told many times that gratitude is associated with overall happiness. And then it seems to me, though, that you can be objectively aware that you should be grateful for things without fully kind of feeling that emotion of gratitude in your life.
That's what happened to me, Chris. You know, that was what was really so strange and perplexing and kind of unpleasant about this period that I wrote about in the article in my 40s, is I had so much to be grateful for. So why was I getting up in the morning and feeling so ungrateful? And of course, when you're as privileged as I am, that just makes you feel even worse, knowing that you should be grateful and you're not. I started to think of myself as something of a whiner. If I had to say in a single sentence why for me my 50s have been a great surprise and kind of a gift, I would use the phrase gratitude has returned. And that is just so important. And it's when I talk to other people writing the article, it's something that would come up again and again as a characteristic of the 50s and beyond into the 60s and 70s. This growing sense of gratitude of, gosh, it's just so satisfying just even to be here. I'm obviously not cheerful all the time and have my bad days like anyone else, but a couple years ago, I realized that I was enjoying breathing. I thought, wow, breathing, this is fun. And that was not how I felt in my 40s.
How would you have lived your 40s differently, or do you think it would have made a difference if you had known about this U-shaped curve and been aware that it was coming?
Yeah. What a great question. I would not have done anything very different. I was talked out of doing stupid things by friends who were older and wiser, like walking in and quitting my job. People said things like, a few people, I could name them for you, said, you know, that's really not a very good idea, John, to quit your job without another job, especially if you have no idea why you're quitting your job. And so I did not mishandle my 40s, so I wouldn't do anything differently. But I sure wish I had known at age 40 what I know at age 54, which is to kind of expect this. And that, it turns out, is a big part of solving the riddle and a big part of why I wrote the article and what I want people to take home. Just knowing that you can face this problem and that it's not about you helps people get through it, because first of all, they know they're not alone. They know they're not crazy. There's nothing wrong with them. Second, they're less likely to make these big mistakes of misattributing what's going on and thinking, well, I've got to throw away my marriage, or, you know, my life is just really boring, so I'm going to give up this great job. So they tend to make fewer mistakes. And then there's this third thing, which a scientist I talked to, an economist named Hannes Schwant, calls the feedback effect. One of the reasons I felt dissatisfied was I was dissatisfied about not feeling satisfied. You know, it's what I said earlier. I couldn't feel grateful. That made me feel like I was a bad person, ungrateful. Had I known that what was going on was completely natural, and that this wasn't sort of a moral fault in my fault, I would have faulted myself less for going through this. So part of what I'm all about now with this article is changing the public narrative around age and happiness so that it's no longer about sort of making fun of people who have midlife crisis because midlife, you know, it's very comical, right? You get the Corvair if you're a man and, you know, Corvette, and you throw away your marriage and aren't you crazy and antisocial and irresponsible? And move it off of that to a different narrative that says for a lot of people who are perfectly ordinary good people, not making mistakes and doing stupid things, 40s, early 50s can be really rough. So let's just understand that. Let's deal with it the way we deal with teenagerness, where we understand it's going to be rough for some people and we're there to help them. Stop making fun of it. And above all, recognize it's completely normal and natural, very common all over the world. It's a very human thing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone to Toby in Richardson. Hello, Toby.
Hi. Really great subject to start off the week. Two questions, very briefly. Number one, I'm wondering if there's been found any correlation as far as how people handle midlife crises, so-called, to genetics. In other words, do people in particular families have a tendency to all have bad, to age badly, have bad midlife crises? And then the second question is, also, is there any correlation that he's aware of between things like maybe in general how bored people are to how well they handle aging? I, for instance, am really never bored, and I would say probably I'm happier than most of the people I know who are saying they're bored on a regular basis.
Well, those are both interesting questions, Toby. We'll talk about them after we take a quick break here. So thank you very much for your call. My guest is Jonathan Rauch. He's a journalist and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's also a contributing editor at The Atlantic. And for the December issue, he has an article in the magazine called The Real Roots of Midlife Crisis. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Jonathan Rauch is my guest this hour. We're talking about his article in the December issue of The Atlantic called The Real Roots of Midlife Crisis. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So Toby wanted to know if you have seen that, I suppose, a proclivity for midlife crisis runs in families, and he was also curious about whether boredom is a factor.
The first question, genetics, is a great question. It's an empirical question, and I haven't seen anything on it. Of course, everything's influenced by genetics, including susceptibility to depression and lots of other things. But my guess is it'll take years to sort all of that out. The second point was interesting, which was about to what extent is boredom a factor? And here I come back to a point I made earlier. It probably is. But remember, what's going on here is very often, as I think it was in my case, independent of circumstances. It's something that's happening as a result of internal changes. And I was feeling bored with my job, even though it wasn't boring, actually. It was the same interesting work that I had loved for a long time. So to some extent, maybe I was burned out and maybe I needed change. And of course, sometimes you're in your 40s and you really do need change. That's why this is complicated. There's no magic solutions. But I think in my case and in some other people's cases, this feeling of boredom and restlessness has more to do with this underlying U-curve than it does the other way around. That is the boredom causing the U-curve. we always want to think of ourselves, Chris, as the agents who shape our own lives. So it's always about me and what I'm doing. And if I'm feeling bored, it must be because I'm not busy enough. But what do you make of it when you're super busy and you're doing what you're good at and love and you're getting rewarded for it and you're still feeling restless and bored? Well, then I think you have to start looking at other explanations. Incidentally, Chris, I happen to know that you're 43.
44.
44?
Yes.
So how does this look to you right now?
You know, I think I tend to be more optimistic than average. I think this is, I definitely have seen some of this among my peers, but I don't feel like, my 30s were rough for a variety of reasons, but I don't feel like my 40s have been so disappointing so far, with the exception of, you know, chauffeuring teenagers all around the city all the time.
Well, you'll be glad to hear that the U-curve is only one of several pretty common patterns. It's probably the most common. But there's also just steady state. A lot of people in these statistical studies are actually quite steady at a pretty high level of contentedness right through life. That's also very common. And then quite a few people actually show an upward sloping line, which is to say that 20s are pretty rough because of all the difficulty getting established and finding yourself. And some people just feel better and better as they get older. The best established part of the relationship between age and happiness, interestingly and to me counterintuitively, is that the last decades tend to be the best, not the worst. I was surprised by that. And I remember talking to a well-known psychologist and saying, that's really surprising and counterintuitive. Aren't we supposed to be sick and curmudgeonly and decrepit and, you know, our old age and as we get older? And her attitude was like, this is such old news. We've known this for years about human beings, but we can't get the story out to the public.
It is interesting when you think about people as they get older. We know that they're often more sort of tolerant. And you bring up in the article, and I think it's fascinating, tolerance of ambiguity and uncertainty. Like, people can live with not having everything they want to know right this minute. And I think that would be a refreshing change for all of us when we get there.
Well, that's right. And these things together, when they start adding up to something like wisdom, that's a really satisfying thing. When you start to feel like people are coming to you because you can bring insight to a situation and a certain kind of balance. Wisdom turns out to be, psychologically speaking and measurably, very different from intelligence. It's a quite, I mean, it helps to be smart, of course, as in everything in life. But it has more to do with these traits like compassion, being able to tolerate ambiguity, judgment, and so forth. And that's a pretty great thing for people to start to feel.
We've had a couple of people asking about the role of hormones. Of course, we know that in midlife, particularly for women, but also for men, like sex hormones change in terms of their percentages in the body. Is there a relationship perhaps between that and the onset of wisdom?
You know, this is what's so unsatisfying to you and to me about doing an interview like this is I keep having to say it. We don't know. We don't know. We don't know.
What we have at this point,
we've got these statistical relationships, which is coming out of economics, which is important because economists don't really study hormones, right, or genes. They just look at these big data sets and go, look what we're finding. So now psychologists are just starting to get into the picture and start to figure out what's going on. That's a long process. But to my knowledge, endocrinologists have not even begun work in this area. I predict that in 10 and 20 years from now, we will know a ton more about the relationship between age and happiness and how to inflect that for the better. We'll know a whole lot more about the roots of wisdom, what it is, what parts of the brain it activates, how to get more of it. I hope that we're on the cusp of thinking in a much more systematic way about happiness and age. And I think that's going to be a really big deal.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Marnie on the line in Grand Saline. Hi, Marnie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple of things. as a female, and I'm in my early 40s, and my girlfriends and I wanted to ask if you feel like if there's any data that supports that women and men handle this differently. I think your stereotype of the man getting the Corvette says that we do. And then secondly, as a female, my girlfriends and I really have felt like the surge of empathy that overwhelms us. And I was wondering if it seems to be empathy without an outlet. And I know another caller, I think Toby, referred to boredom. But empathy without an outlet to me is where the overwhelming frustration and depression and things come from, that you don't have a place to, as an adult, find to vent these positive energies or find a way to make these look more positive. But you see the world and you feel that I feel like I have become just this surge of an empathy, and it can lead to a depressing sort of perspective, if you will. And I wondered if your thoughts on that.
Well, thanks for your call, Marty. It almost sounds like maybe where that resolves for some people, Jonathan, is in that sort of focus on volunteerism and doing for other people that sometimes seems to come at the end of midlife.
And social connectedness, yes. And empathy, of course, is, as compassion, to which it's very closely related, is very much part of the package that distinguishes people who are wise. They're good at sort of seeing, understanding what other people need. It also goes to tolerance of ambiguity. I don't know about empathy without an outlet. It's not something I've thought about, and I'm not even completely sure what it would mean, because, you know, people with friends and family and social networks, there are always ways to be empathetic. On the first question, the male versus female difference, I went into this research expecting to find that men are more prone to midlife dissatisfaction than women. And guess what? Does not turn up in the data. Sex differences just don't seem to be very consequential. And indeed, when I went and talked to people informally, just part of my article, as you'll see, I had conversations with people to give this some texture. You'll see it turned out men, women said the same kinds of things. I have a guess, actually. It's not an original idea, but that one of the reasons that midlife crisis per se gets associated more with men than for women is that until very recently, men were the ones in the position to sort of express themselves in these bold, sometimes foolhardy ways. You know, they were the people who had control of the money and the professional lives, and they were the decision makers in the household. And so it may have been that because of the unequal status of women, that men were able to act out more. But that, of course, is also just conjecture. And in terms of the underlying relationship between age and life satisfaction, it seems like men and women are kind of in the same boat.
We have an email here from Scott who says, I'm always concerned that these discussions about fulfillment apply only to a narrow social and economic strata of society. Those whose lives are beset by just getting by may have a completely different way of defining fulfillment. Can these ideas be applied to the poor?
Yes. One of the nice things about having this finding come out of big data and economics is that countries and cultures all over the world are surveyed with lots of different questions by different survey instruments and surveyors on their satisfaction with life. And you certainly do find the U-curve is more prevalent in wealthy and Western countries, where you can go on at the tail end of life to have good health care and good life expectations. Those things absolutely help. But when you look at adjusted numbers, you also find this pattern commonly in poor countries as well. You don't find it as commonly, but it turns up in places like, for example, Mongolia. It turns up in poor countries, in relatively poor countries in Eastern Europe, for example, South America. And of course, there are those chimps and orangutans. So this is not primarily a story about money and privilege.
Do you think as we learn more about wisdom, and particularly the wisdom that comes from life experience, that we will kind of leave older people alone to make their own choices and not assume that if they're not still living like us, they must be doing something wrong?
Gee, I'm not sure. I think older people, I think we do leave them alone pretty much. So I'm not sure I'm with you on the premise of the question.
Hmm.
I think what we do tend to do is undervalue people beyond a certain age, especially right now. We're at a social moment, Chris, where, you know, every disruptive innovation, move fast and break things. Anybody in their 20s is probably a genius about to launch the next Facebook, and people in their 50s and 60s are washed up. Well, it turns out there's a lot of evidence on this, and it shows that people in their 50s and 60s have every bit as much to offer as younger people. They tend to be just as productive. They offer benefits of their own to the workplace in terms of wisdom and balance. One of the things that I hope will come out of this research is better appreciation, first, that getting old does not make you useless, and two, getting old does not make you miserable.
Is wisdom itself a source of happiness?
I think so. And I couldn't claim to have found much evidence of that yet. This is, again, this is a field in its infancy. But I have very little doubt that it is. And when I talk to folks about what was changing in their own life, this would come up again and again. They'd say, they wouldn't always use the word wisdom, but they'd say feeling better balanced, feeling better able to judge things, feeling calmer, more tranquil, feeling more appreciative of others. What they're describing is the packet of traits, not just that makes them happy, but that societies down through time have identified with wisdom.
Who
wants to be less wise? I guess maybe when we're striving kids, we don't always want to be wise, but the rest of us, it's a good thing.
So are you at a place now where you're thinking, gosh, I can't wait to be 70? Or are you, in fact, living, for the most part, in the moment?
Well, I'm a classic case right now because I've hit the crossover point. There's actually a curve that shows this. It's a cool graph that Hannes Schwant, the economist, did. And I'm at the place where I'm early in this stage where the expectations game is now working for me instead of against me. So instead of being unpleasantly surprised every year because things are not as good as I thought they'd be, I'm pleasantly surprised every year because things are better than they thought they'd be. So I'm at the beginning of this stage of feeling better about stuff. When I talk to folks, the people, professionals, these are the psychologists and the economists, the people who work on this, they say, and also talking about their own lives, they said, just wait till you're 60.
Hmm.
Emotional life, for many people, very commonly peaks in the 60s and 70s. So people tell me I have a whole lot to look forward to. And having done this research, I now believe it.
Journalist Jonathan Rauch is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His article, The Real Roots of Midlife Crisis, appears in the December issue of The Atlantic magazine, where he is a contributing editor. Jonathan, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Mashal Noor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.